And good morning. This is PFG Live. How is everybody? It's Sunday. It's about 2 p.m., but what does that mean anymore? Because we just went through this time change. It's 2 p.m. on the East Coast of the United States, and we are 4 hours west of UTC as of right now. Carl Tauber is reporting 50 degrees Fahrenheit and partly sunny after last night's rain in the People's Republic of Rhode Island, which was snow in other parts of the Northeast. Let's see. CJ Stevens has checked in. He says 51 and sunny in East Tennessee. Jeff Lawford, welcome aboard, sir. Cloudy and 18 degrees Fahrenheit in Wasilla, Alaska. And I can see your house from here. Practical Renaissance is here. Sunny and 54 Fahrenheit in Kansas City, Missouri. Say hello to my folks across the river. Greenwood AG reports partly cloudy, 37 degrees Fahrenheit. Winds are east at 10 miles an hour in south central Idaho. Also, on the other side of the inner tubes, let's see who checked in with weather here. Warren Jones from Sutton, New Hampshire, up north, checks in at 43 degrees, sunny and snowy. Everything is soggy. So Warren is sufficiently far north from me that he had to shovel some snow. And we have green pastures here. Nothing but green pastures. So DBX is checking in with White Plains at 1256. Zulu reporting winds 350 at 7 knots. Visibility 10 miles. Clear. Temperature 04, dew point minus 01, altimeter 3030. Remarks? We have a remark. It's a high wind alert. Interesting. Evils is reporting in with a fake METAR. All remarks in which he says it is just fine in his office. Josh is here from southern Manitoba. Clear and sunny with 1.5 degrees science, minus 4.0 degrees science dew point and 67% calculated humidity with double audio checks. Scott M. is here from Peoria, Illinois. Yes, Peoria, Illinois, 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Tuck is here from Buffalo, New York, reporting 33 degrees Fahrenheit with light snow flurries. Now you know where they start. Widget Works is here. Welcome, sir. 0 degrees science, sunny in the Great White North. Robert Simpson is here at 34 degrees Fahrenheit, overcast in the general vicinity, though deniably Detroit. Let's see. Oh, we got a few others here. Flatlapper, sir. We still haven't talked, but I haven't forgotten you. Welcome aboard. 40 degrees Fahrenheit, sunny, 18 miles an hour in North Illinois. Chris J. is here. Welcome, Chris. 54 dungarees, Frankenstein in Southwest Mo. Indiana John says 42, of course, 42 degrees Fahrenheit, slushy and cloudy in Thornton, New Hampshire. Thornton. You know, I don't think I've ever been in Thornton. Maybe we have to fix that someday. Let's see. Did we get Robert Simpson? Robert Simpson says 34 degrees Fahrenheit, overcast near Detroit. Yes, we did get him. He was in the general vicinity of Detroit. So welcome, everybody. It's Sunday here in the Windham, New Hampshire. It's 48 degrees, 70% relative humidity, winds out of the west, 13 miles an hour. Whereas, and indubitably, at the Manchester Airport at 1753 Zulu, winds are 300, 17 gusting, 26 knots, 10-mile visibility, overcast 3,300, temperature 10, dew point 01, altimeter 29er, 21. Remarks, altimeter, peak winds of at 300 at 26, reported at 1745. It's a windy day. So let's see, almost is checking in, 70 degrees Fahrenheit in Surprise, Arizona, and breezy. Awesome. Welcome. It has been a week. It has been a week. So first of all, thank you to the new subscribers. If you're new to the channel, welcome aboard. We're currently sitting at 1,353 YouTube subscribers. We have a number of podcast subscribers that I have not really accurately enumerated. Plus, we have all the folks on Instagram. So welcome aboard. We have a bunch of stuff to cover. I'll remind you that this is sponsored by PFGstones.com. Get flat, stay flat with PFG Stones. That'll do it. Let's see. And with that, we lost two viewers. I'm out of here. It was a beautiful, blue, crisp day in Vermont. Just north of Warren, Vermont. And I was flying my glider. The glider was a Grobe Astier CS. A one-holer, 15 meters, a little beefy. Not competitive, but fun. And I was relatively green, especially with respect to flying cross-country. Now, in the world of glider flying, cross-country means you have left the airport and you're going somewhere else. So I headed up north in the valley, and I was having a good time. And there was maybe 10% cloud cover, and they were cumulus clouds. Cumulus clouds mark the top of thermals. Thermals are convection in the atmosphere. And where the air goes up, a glider can circle and gain altitude. But it was getting on to early afternoon. I don't remember exactly. And I was really enjoying my flight, but I stopped finding lift. Lift is the term we use for rising air. In this case, it was from thermals. Sometimes the atmospheric conditions change rapidly and the thermals stop. They just turn off. Sometimes the thermals don't get organized until they're above a certain altitude. I don't remember why, but I was out of lift. No problem. I was trained for this. So as I looked around and realized I was not going to get any more lift, and I was not going to get back to the home airport, and I was not going to get up to Morrisville, I realized I was landing out. Landing out is a term of art, which means you're landing, but you're not landing at an airport. So you start looking for a field to land in. And this is one of the training things that we do in gliders, is how do you pick a field? So I looked around and I had a couple of prospects of fields to land in, and I picked one. It was not a great choice, but it was better than the other two. And I committed. So I started getting myself ready for that landing. And I'm watching my situation. I note the wind. I note the terrain of this very short field. It was long enough. And I note the altimeter. And that was a mistake. Because somewhere in my brain, I made a connection between the current altimeter display and my relationship to this field, which, of course, in the comfort of our easy chairs, and in retrospect especially, the altimeter has nothing to do with the field you're looking at because you don't know the altitude of the field. And that was a fundamental mistake because it was different. Our airport in Warren, the Warren Sugarbush Airport, is actually pretty elevated compared to other parts of the valley. So as I am skillfully setting up for a downwind leg to land in this field, I was too high. But my brain was telling me I was just right. So It wasn't obvious to me until probably I was on base leg. Now, base leg is when you're flying perpendicular to the line of your landing and you're about to make a 90 degree turn. I think in this case, it was a left turn. I don't remember. That's sort of the standard. And I realized I screwed up. But I screwed up in a way that I really did not have a good recovery from. Because we don't have an engine in a glider. And your job in landing any aircraft, is to go through a window, which is essentially at the threshold of the runway or the perimeter of the airport, for example. You're going through this window at the right altitude, at the right airspeed, in the right configuration. It doesn't matter how you get there. But if you go through that window at the right airspeed, at the right altitude, and in the right configuration, you can land. So as I turned final, I had my spoilers out. And the spoilers on this glider were magnificent. There was like two billboards that came directly out of the top of the wings and generated a whole bunch of drag and spoiled a whole bunch of lift from the wing. So they were alternately called spoilers or we call them spoilers. There's other names for them. Air brakes are spoilers, but we call them spoilers because their main job is to spoil the lift. The Grobe Astier CS had magnificent spoilers. I had them all the way out. I could not have pulled more on the left-hand handle to stick them further out into the airstream than I already had, though I did try. And the only thing I had left to do is to slip. Slipping involves stepping on one of the rudder pedals to the floor, which yaws the aircraft, and then counteracting the yaw with the ailerons and leaving the rudder pinned to one side. Now the aircraft is literally flying sideways. The effect of the wings lift is diminished, and you are now getting a lot more drag and generating less lift, and you are coming down like a homesick brick, which is the desired result. Only the manual for the Grobe Astier CS specifically states, do not slip with full spoilers. Sometimes the manual doesn't matter. I had done this before, so this was not being a test pilot, but I had full slip, full spoilers, and I was on final for a field which was about 500 feet long. The fence was white. It was one of those fences that have like two logs across them, you know, and it was white. And my window, I had to go over that fence by inches, and I had to be going, I don't remember my exact airspeed requirement at the time, about 60 knots, maybe less. And I had to have my gear down. So I was already geared down. I was full spoiler. My airspeed was coming down. I did not know if I was going to make it to the window. And I looked at the field, which was small. On the left side was an old stone barn. On the right side was a very big oak tree. And I said, okay, I'm going to take off the right wing with that oak tree. And I'm going to avoid the stone foundation of the barn, and I'll probably live through this. These are the thoughts that occurred as I approached
the window.
I crossed over that fence by inches at the right airspeed in the right configuration, and I put the glider down in the field. I had dozens of feet to spare before I would hit something by the time I came to a stop. The feeling I had upon stopping that aircraft and opening my canopy was the same feeling I had at the end of Thursday when I crashed my grinder. Okay, I said it. I crashed my grinder. So, similar things happened. Yes, CJ Stevens, change of pants was definitely in order. Indiana John, I'm sorry I didn't answer your question, but I think I answered your question. No flaps. This is a standard class glider, so there's no flaps. But if there were flaps, I would have been, you know, in the right configuration. I crashed my grinder. So remember in the story, which, by the way, is 100% accurate and true, and one day I'll find the pictures from it. When I glanced at my altimeter and my brain saw a number and made the decision that everything was cool, and that was a mistake, the same thing happened on the grinder. In full auto mode, at the top of the screen, I'm sorry I don't have a shot of this, but there's this obscure little field that says compensation. And what happens is, you have, in full auto mode, it looks like you're looking at a spreadsheet. It literally looks like a spreadsheet. And you're going to execute that line, and that line of the spreadsheet. Thank you, Indiana John. It was at least as intense as I described. But let me back up for a second. One of the points of the story is that while it's happening, you've got business to do. And you're doing the business. You're doing A, you're doing B, you're doing C. And you're any emotional content you is pushed off for either another day or never. And it's pushed off until the aircraft is tied down, which in my case was, it came to a stop. The wing touched the ground. You know, that's what happens in gliders because we only have one wheel. And you could literally feel the adrenaline. Just now the adrenaline has nowhere to go. And you just, this weird stuff happens and the emotions come up and all this, these things happen. So, by the way, well, I'll tell that story later. So, on the grinder, there's a number called compensation on the full auto page, which I was newly using in my process. And in doing so, I was a little overconfident, and I was very proud of this number. And my brain said, everything's fine. However, when I went to start a new process, that number stayed there. And it has the effect of taking all of the numbers in your spreadsheet in the full auto programming mode on the Okamoto grinder and lowering them by the amount in the compensation, which in this case was minus 0.25 inches. On a grinder, that's approximately 7,000 miles, okay? And it's for reasons, which I'm not going to explain now because it's too obscure. But
It was left. It was a leftover number, and there was no place in my system to deal with that number in a appropriate way. There is now. In fact, I made a little tool that has magnets on it that sticks to the control panel of the glider, of the grinder, and reminds me to check the compensation value if it's in use. And if it's not in use and it's zero, I take that and I stick it somewhere else. Yeah, I've been told that before. So the wheel was a quarter inch lower than it should have been, and I couldn't detect it visually because of reasons, and I didn't have it in my checklist, and I hit the green button. Now, usually what happens is the grinder starts, and I look inside to check the wheel position with respect to the top of the work, which in this case was stones. Jeff Lawford says, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? Exactly correct. So when I did that and I hit the green button and I'm looking at it, I'm saying, oh, that looks low. But it was sufficiently low to hit the steel screw as part of my fixturing. And at 3,600 RPM, a metal bond diamond wheel smashed into a steel screw, probably 150 to 200 thousandths deep, and shit happened. Luckily, I had lowered the threshold of the current in the motor, in the spindle motor, and it alarmed out and cut off power to the spindle motor, which probably saved the day. It took all day Thursday. That was, by the way, that was the first button push, not the first button push, but the first start of a grinding process on Thursday, so that I can, you know, start the grinder, go upstairs and keep working up in the lab. And that was the very first button push. So all of Thursday was recovering from that. I am happy to report, just to release a little bit of tension here, that I did completely recover from that. There were two main parts of that recovery. First part was I had a call, I had to phone a friend. I had to call an expert. And I don't think I'm going to identify him because he might not want to be identified in this particular context. But he intimately knew the make, model, and serial number of this grinder and what was inside that spindle. And to make a long story short, I had to do some very interesting things to realign that spindle, which I'm happy to report I did, which increases my confidence of being able to do it again. But while I was doing it, I was not a happy camper. I brought the spindle back to 00. The second part of the recovery involved recovering the wheel. Now, they don't give these wheels away. This is a $500 metal bond diamond wheel. And I just smashed it into a steel screw. The steel had smeared about 3/4 of the way around the wheel, embedding steel into the matrix. It had shifted the wheel on the hub. The hub was a Renzetti modified hub, I should say a Renzetti modification hub, where the lock ring on the Sopko adapter was drilled for 6 set screws. And the cylinder of the adapter was ground down to a smaller diameter, so it had a little motion available to it, a little movement inside the hole. So the idea is you lightly tighten the 6 set screws and then you tap the wheel in for perfect alignment on the hub. The side effect is that during this crash, the wheel shifted on the hub. Actually, not a bad thing, because the shifting of the wheel used up some energy in a good place. So I removed everything. obviously, when I was dealing with the spindle, when I put it back on, I had loosened the set screws. I tapped the wheel back into concentricity. I had to indicate on the surface of the wheel using an indicator and a piece of shim stock so that the indicator wouldn't be damaged by the diamonds. But also, I had to do it right at the rim of the wheel because it was smeared with steel. And I was able to do that. I got the wheel concentric and tightened down the set screws. So now the wheel was back. Now I had to get the surface of the wheel back. I took two dressing sticks. These are white aluminum oxide sticks that you use to dress a diamond wheel, both a metal bond and a resin bond diamond wheel. A resin bond is the more common and less expensive wheel. And in either case, the dressing stick removes the matrix that the diamonds are being held by and lowers that so it exposes the diamonds so that the diamonds can do their job. So these dressing sticks are in stock. They're in my drawer. They're consumables. They're like paper towels. And I used up an entire stick to get that wheel clean. So when you hit this contaminated wheel with this stick, it makes sparks, the same sparks you make when you grind steel. That was wonderful because when it stopped making sparks, that means I got rid of all the steel. That took at least a full stick. I ended up using two full sticks on Thursday to dress that wheel back to, quote, normal. Once I got all the steel out of the wheel, I switched to now truing the wheel using a molybdenum stick. Oh, by the way, asterisk, I plan on stocking, there's somebody that's going to be very happy when they hear this, we will be stocking molybdenum for molybdenum dressing of diamond wheels, by the way, in the PFG Stones store, okay? So that's coming shortly. So if you're interested in that, stay tuned. So I went ahead and I executed my truing procedure using molybdenum. Using molybdenum, we slow down the wheel. In my case, I'm now using 700 RPM on the wheel and a 2,000th down feed using a stick of molybdenum. I believe I used up, I believe I downfed a total of 100,000ths. That's a lot. 2,000ths at a time. I believe it took me 50 passes to get what my ears told me was a proper dress using the molybdenum. And then my fingers confirmed it, and everything started looking pretty reasonable. After I dressed, I trued with the molybdenum, I then again dressed. That was the second stick, the second dressing stick. And I dressed again. By the time all of that was done, I had recovered from the crash. I had a happy spindle, although it had a headache. I had a happy wheel, trued and dressed. And actually, when I was all done, that wheel has not looked that good in I can't tell you how long. And then, you know what I did? I took the wheel, I marked the spindle position and the wheel position. I removed the wheel and I took it over to the BS8 balancing stand available at the Kinetic Precision store. And I balanced that wheel. I'm trying to remember if it needed any actual balancing. No, I checked it and it was fine. Okay. It didn't need any balancing. Went back to the machine, put it back on the machine, and it was ready for work. That was now the end of Thursday. That was about 5:30 p.m. on Thursday. The crash occurred at approximately 9 a.m. So from that was the evolution of that event. At the end of that day, I felt at the end of the day when I landed my glider in that field and walked away. And that's why I told you the grinder story, because there's so many things in common with this crash and that non-crash that I learned a bunch of lessons. So, okay, one of the lessons is fly the airplane. It doesn't matter that you screwed up. You've got to fly the airplane. If you stop flying the airplane, it's clear what happens. You got to keep flying the airplane. So when the crash happened on the grinder, sounds like glider, but it isn't. When the crash happened on the grinder, you have to keep flying the airplane. Now, did I jump up and down and want to punch something? Yes. But I couldn't stop. I had to recover that grinder, recover from that crash, and keep on going because I'm in business on that grinder, right? And it took me away from business upstairs in the lab, which I won't dive into. So you have to keep going. You have to just breathe. The crash happens, breathe. What's the next step? What do I have to do? What's the best next decision? What's the best next person to call to ask questions? What's the tools? What are the tools that I need, et cetera, et cetera. And you just keep going until the problem is solved. And that is what happened on Thursday. It sucked. I look back on it and I'm like, wow, I learned a whole bunch and I did recover and I executed a bunch of my skills and they worked. And I called the right consigliere and they helped and it all worked. So that was Thursday and I'll just leave that with you and happy to answer questions about it. So Josh asks, how did you get the glider home? So the act of landing out is not a unusual or exotic event. I mean, at the home airport, it's a little unusual, but whenever you go glider flying, you have a designated crew. And if you don't have a designated crew, at the very least, you leave your keys in your car and your car hooked up to your trailer. And you might not intend to land out, but if you land out, you could always call back to the airport on a payphone and, you know, tell them where you are and come get you. By the way, this all happened before cell phones existed. So, yeah, it's a couple of these gray hairs on the side. So, or you know you're going to land out and you say to Bob, hey, Bob, would you be my crew today? Oh, yeah, sure, no problem. And you give Bob your car keys. And if Bob gets the call, Bob's got to hook up and head for you and pick you up. So we disassemble the glider in the field, put it in the trailer, and drive home. And if I was a beer drinking kind of guy, that's when the beer starts getting drunk. But I'm not, and I didn't. Good question. And any other questions, I'd be happy to answer. So breathe. Step one. Step two, fly the aircraft. We have a saying from those days, avigate, navigate, communicate in that order. So, what else happened last week? So, moving on to other things. Oh, I had posted some interesting references to time this morning. And, here's a question. Evil says, yeah, I know. So Evil's is designing a new sticker for us. Check glinder attitude. Altitude check glinder altitude. Yeah, they could do something. Josh says, thanks for sharing. Good to hear the process working through a problem. Yeah, it's very different when you're in the middle of it than you're just talking about it. That's for sure. So I did reference the fact that we just came out of a time change, right? So this is now, I don't remember if this is Eastern Daylight Time, Eastern Savings, who knows? I don't care. So we are now GMT minus 4. Yesterday we were GMT minus 5. That's all you need to know. I do have a time and frequency reference here in the lab. One of the guys on Instagram was asking me about it, and yes, it is true. In the lab right now, I have a rubidium oscillator inside of a box made by Symmetricom, which is a time and frequency standard. So it receives GPS signals, and it locks a clock to the GPS signals, and it synchronizes a rubidium oscillator. So if you lose the GPS signals, the rubidium oscillator just keeps on coasting. And I won't get too deep into the numbers, but it's ridiculous. It's way better than a part per billion in time and frequency accuracy. And of course, it stays synchronized via GPS. So if you don't know what time it is, you can go to ntp.antennasys.net or gps.antennasys.net. gps.antennasys.net takes you directly to the time and frequency reference. A big thank you to WidgetWorks, who is in the Discord server. So I'm getting ready. First of all, let me acknowledge our Discorders here. Tuck's Garage, WidgetWorks, Evils, Warren Jones, DBX, Lance K, Almost Machining, Josh, Scott M, Robert Simpson, and Carl Tauber are all in the Discord server. Welcome, gentlemen. And I know I'm making some assumptions. Yes, actually, Indiana John, the turbo encabulator uses a slightly different part that has a different alloy or frameulus. So it's close. It's very close. fixing to get ready to make some toolmakers flats. So the toolmakers flats are going to be very interesting. They're going to be lapped to gauge block quality on one or both sides. I don't see a reason not to do both sides. And in setting up for the heat treating process, yeah, Robert Simpson correctly points out that it has a different base plate than the turbo encabulator. Thank you, Mr. Simpson. I appreciate that. I wanted to put a wire hanger or carrier around the toolmaker's plate so that I can grab it by that wire as I transport it in or out of heat treat. And I needed a high temperature wire. And I've had some high temperature safety wire around here, which is essentially an Inconel. Long story short, WidgetWorks had this very fancy, super high temperature material, which is used in TIG welding for very high temperature applications. It was perfect for this. And he was cleaning up. He was trying to get clutter credits. And I said, I'll take it. Send it to me. So he is actually sending it to me. Thank you very much, sir. So that's going to become our hangers for these parts in the heat treating process. The material is 52-100 steel. I have researched the recommended gauge block heat treating process. I'm going to do a slightly modified version of that. We are going to heat treat at 1550. Did somebody leave the back door open? Robin just came in. I said the word lapping and Robin shows up. Yes, you heard the word lapping, but it's only in passing. We're going to talk about the main event here in a second. Stick around because you may have something to say. Robin, welcome to the Discord server. So 52-100 seal, we decided on, I think it's 1550 degrees Fahrenheit. A quench in fast quenching oil, so-called 11-second oil, continued quench into cryo, where we'll be cryoing down to liquid nitrogen temperatures. I found this really cool, big, wide-mouth gallon-sized insulated stainless steel thermos. That's a trademark, of course. And I put a link on the pfg.gg/links page that looks like it's going to be perfect as the liquid nitrogen container. The liquid nitrogen container is going to be inside of a cooler. I haven't figured this out quite yet. I might put dry ice around the liquid nitrogen container because dry ice is cheap. Liquid nitrogen is expensive. So we'll have this stepped temperature gradient out to a big fat styrofoam cooler. That will do a long-term, like 24-hour type cryo treatment. Then they're going to come out of cryo treatment. They're going to go into 250 degree Fahrenheit temper, again, long term, like 9 hours. Then they're going to come back out. The jury's out as to whether we'll go back into cryo, but basically you can see what's happening. It's going to be a very nice, thorough heat treating, excellent transformation of austenite, I'm getting it wrong, to martensite. And when we're all done, and these parts will have been lathe turned, by the way, and I think surface ground. And then when the heat treating is all done, no, they won't be surface ground. They're going to be lathe turned. Out of heat treat, they go to surface grinding. And then out of surface grinding, they go to lapping. This is flat lapping. And the flat lapping is going to be done via a recipe to be determined. So we'll keep you guys. Yeah. Austenite or austenite? WidgetWorks posted a whole paragraph. Oh, is that the alloy? Oh yeah. If you guys want to read about the alloy that WidgetWorks is sending me, you could read about it in his paragraph right there. It's pretty cool stuff. It's a nickel alloy. It's called RA602. So that's the description of my plan so far. I think it's going to come out quite nice. When we get to the gauge block quality lapping, you can rest assured there's going to be some stories to tell and lessons to learn. And a certain person who may or may not live in the state of Pennsylvania is going to earn himself a couple of dinners out of this. Anyway, we're having fun. This is great. It's a good time. The ultimate goal, I have an ulterior motive, and that is I have another project in which I need to master the art of this particular lap, this lapping in the end. But also, I think this is a cool product that we'll put on the store. And I mentioned that before. It won't be cheap. I'm sorry. So that's the update on Toolmakers Flats, Cryo, Heat Treat. Okay, we got the spelling. Thank you, Evils. Austenite. Austenite is also known as the gamma phase iron. The austenite allotrope is named after Sir William Chandler Roberts Austin. Now you know. Metallurgy, right? It's crazy. Yeah. We did that. Okay. So they're going to almost be exactly like a hockey puck. Yeah. Three inch. It's a 3-inch diameter. So I showed this before. Robin had made some Toolmaker flats and I talked to Robin and he has a nice groove around his. Okay. I'm holding it up to the camera. For all you guys on the audio version of the podcast, imagine a hockey puck with a 1/2 inch deep, 3/8 inch wide groove around its periphery, centrally located between the two flats. I think I've just given you a full description. Robins were 1 1/8 inch thick. We're kind of heading for that dimension, although that's not clear if it's going to be exactly that. So that was what Robin had made. And I'm like, okay, I'll make it, the same dimensions. And Robin
has shown that he can clamp to it with little clamps to clamp to that lip, which is kind of cool. So I like it. And Warren Jones asks, like a hockey puck, will it weigh 6 ounces? On what planet, Warren? I believe there is a planet on which it will weigh 6 ounces. I don't know. I haven't calculated how much they weigh, but we'll find out. So this is going to be a lot of fun. And as Warren says, Robin said, you know, you just put a groove around it with the grooving tool. Zip, zip, zip. I think that's a quote, right, Robin? Zip, zip, zip. Also, Josh says it's too tall. A regulation hockey puck is 3 inches by 1 inch. It will be non-regulation because that's how we roll here. Test Room 2003 is checking in late. Hi from... hang on, I got to remember. Yeah, Oostkapelle, Netherlands. 8 degrees science, 89% relative humidity. Welcome, sir. One day I will be able to pronounce that without thinking. So we made some progress in the cryo room. I called my liquid nitrogen supplier.
I called my supplier. So I'm going to need a whole bunch of the cold stuff.
And they said, no problem. Let us know when you need it. I buy a 10 liters. This we're going to make 3 flats in the first run and hopefully that will bring the process in for a landing. I think we're only going to be able to make 3 or 4. 3 might be the right number at a time. We'll find out. So that's the update on Toolmaker's flats. So I have been fighting with these rolls from the sign plate project. If you've been following my series called Quick Chips, there's 2 projects underway. One hasn't been touched in a week, which is the right angle, but that's going to come in for a landing as soon as we mount up the cup wheel, which I haven't done yet. But then I started working on lapping the rolls. So the rolls were surface ground as matched and as taper free as I was able to get it using the tools available to me at the time, a couple of weeks ago. But there was a tenth or two that needed to get taken out of taper. So I decided we're going to lap it in. So I will show you. I think I showed this picture. Well, it was in our... here we go. It was in the thumbnail. I made an aluminum lap, which I've done before, and I... Indiana John says, will they perform like hockey pucks with hydrostatic floating on surface plates? They actually should, so stay tuned. We may have a new air hockey table, the world's most expensive air hockey table. So I made an aluminum lap, and if you look closely at the picture, there's a slot through it, clear through on one side, and on the other side, it's a relief slot so that it can bend easy. And then I put a hose clamp around it as a tensioner, and I started lapping on the lathe. So if you look at that picture, you'll see the roll is mounted with a long bolt through it to an aluminum arbor. And then the head of the bolt is turned down so that it clears the approximately 0.610 diameter of the roll. And off I went to start lapping. So it was a little weird. I'm not gonna lie. I was not getting a joyous, simple, smooth, predictable process. And is probably a bunch of reasons for that. But I started with some of my 5-micron aluminum oxide in oil, which I've used before, and it started lapping, and it was pretty nice, but boy, howdy, was it slow. So I actually needed to move as much as 2/10 on this diameter, which doesn't sound much to you guys with,
you know, great big honking lathe tools, but this, you know, with 5 micron aluminum oxide, it was not going too quickly. So then I decided it was time to experiment. I switched to the so-called Time Saver lapping compound. Now, the Time Saver lapping compound is actually garnet. And the whole, its whole claim to fame is that it will eventually just use itself up and go away, and you don't have to, you know, it doesn't embed in the aluminum. Neither does the aluminum oxide embed in the aluminum, which sounds a little circular, but it's true. So it was non-embedding. So I started with a medium grit. I tried it for a while. I wasn't getting very far. So I played around a little bit more with the fine grit. I know that sounds backwards. No, I did it the other way. I went with the fine grit, then I went to the medium grit. So here's a point I want to make about the Time Saver. So Tom Lipton has talked about the Time Saver lapping compound before, and I think everybody's talked about it. But it does, because it goes away on its own and it doesn't embed, you can actually go from a coarse Time Saver to a fine Time Saver, which you cannot do with diamond. So if you have a, for example, aluminum lap or brass lap, and you use a certain, let's say, 8 micron diamond, and later you want to go to a 3 micron diamond, you can't use that lap anymore because those diamonds at 8 microns are embedded in that lap. Whereas with a Time Saver, you actually can. So it actually saves some time. They should call it that. So I played around with that. Still was either taking forever or it just was not soul satisfying. So I decided to go to diamond. So I went to my favorite stuff, which is a diamond paste, which I was, I don't know what you call it, encouraged to buy, cajoled to buy, from Hyperion. It comes in these hypodermic squeezy tubes. This particular one says 2-4, which I believe means 2-4 micron diamond. And I started playing with that. And I started moving some material, and I started getting some good results, and this made me unreasonably happy. Let's see, I have again, if you're looking at the video, here's the card after diamond lapping on unit number 2. If you throw out the measurements at the very, very end of the roll, it was 0000000. It was absolutely cylindrical, and I was very happy. So the punchline on that is that the diamond, you know, I'm going to say, Robin said it before, don't waste your time on anything that isn't diamond, essentially is what he said. And I think in this case, it's absolutely true. So the diamond actually started behaving the way I needed it to behave. So the next step of this process is making the other roll, which happens to be roll number 1, match roll number 2. So roll number 1 is going to need a significant amount of work. Let's see. I'll give you the data here. Let's see if I have it. Nope. Yeah, here's some of the data from the upper one was before any lapping at all, and the extreme spread of the diameters, taking the center as 0, was a total of about 5/10, -2 on one, +3 on the other. So there were some significant tenths that have to get moved. Yeah, Evils, I'm not done yet. Evil says, wouldn't you want to knock off that high spot on one end? The answer is yes, but we're not done yet. We're still bringing this thing in for a landing. Yeah, Robin says 9 micron is a nice size for material removal and decent finish. So the good news is I have one more size up available to me in stock in the pastes. So I might kick it up a size. And I think that one, I can't quite remember what the numbers are, but I think it's very close to what you're talking about. Also, I have liquid slurry in 8. So I have some options that I may be playing with, and I guess we're going to be talking about this a little more. But the good news is if you start evaluating these things, like numerically, because I was getting a little frustrated, but then when you stopped and just measured, and I did all these measurements, and then you looked at the numbers, I had, you know, even when I was feeling frustrated, I had cut my spread of my measurements from over 4/10 to about 2/10. So I cut my error in half. So we're heading in the right direction. We haven't overshot anything. The ultimate goal is round, straight, and matched in size. So there's no particular size I have to hit. These two units just have to be round, straight, and matched. So I started using, one of the things I did is I started using a V-block. And I started, let's see, I'll show you the V-block setup. I posted that to Instagram. I might not have that picture handy. Nope, I don't have that picture handy. But I put the rolls in a V-block to make those measurements, but also I rotated them 90 degrees and repeated the measurements. Yeah, Robin says, a cheap Schar's indicating mic is your friend when doing parts like these. So I was using my not cheap Mitutoyo mic and setting it to the center of the roll, hitting the relative key or whatever they call it, the incremental key. And then that made for a very easy, plus or minus measurement down the roll. Evil says was going to ask about keeping the diamond off the measurement tools. Okay. So what I did was, if you go back to the thumbnail or this show, you'll see that it is pretty gooped up with oily diamond compound or greasy diamond compound. I would stop. I would take a clean paper towel. I would spray it with my solvent, which is denatured alcohol. I would wipe it. I would fold the paper towel, use more denatured alcohol. I would wipe it. And basically I would get the thing clean. And then I would clean my hands and go pick up the micrometer from 5 feet away, bring it over, and make my process measurements. If I was going to bring it to the surface plate, again, I would take the bolt out. Well, first I would clean it while it was on the arbor using my denatured alcohol, a couple of paper towels. You might notice I go through a lot of paper towels. That's because I go through a lot of paper towels. And then, get it good and clean and then bring it over to the lapping plate clean. I was also wearing gloves. You can see in the picture that I'm wearing my nitrile gloves. And that helped keep the stuff off my hands. So yeah, clean is pretty important, but you have to go back and forth between measuring. So somehow you have to have a process. You may also notice that I had brown paper covering my lathe, my lathe bits. I eventually decided that the covering on the chuck was egregious. I didn't need it. I got rid of it. You'll see that in the video. So I did a bunch of video snippets and I'll be pasting all those together for a quick chips on this, but I was so focused. I didn't publish anything. Robin says the analog needle of the indicating mic is better than a digital mic for assessing cylindricity, as you can easily see 20 micro inches deviations that won't show in the digital mic. Totally understand. And as soon as my technique gets good enough, or as soon as I think I'm done, I can get down to that. But I right now, if I just see, better than 50 micro inches down the pipe, happy to change to something finer. But right now I'm roughing. This is all roughing. We're talking tenths here, dude. I'm shoveling the stuff off. So we're getting there, but I'm having fun and I'm learning a lot. And one of the things that I observed while I was lapping was this weird indication of banana. Like, okay, that's odd. So I started hypothesizing that maybe my arbor bolt, you know, that bolt that I modified was too tight and it was banana-ing the roll. This was really kind of confusing. So that is a possibility. I lightened up on my torque on the that bolt. I went from 125 foot-pounds down to 60 foot-pounds. I'm kidding. But like I said, eventually things started making sense. Diamonds fix everything. That's what my wife tells me. And here we are. It's Sunday. And I'm not going to lie, I'm still recovering from Thursday. It was pretty traumatizing. Anyway, I think I've delivered everything I came to deliver. You guys are awesome. One minor nit this week. You may recall I had these clear framed safety glasses that I got from Philips Safety Products, I think it's called, online, and I was actually pretty happy about it, pretty excited about it, because I had a new prescription. They failed. And they failed in a way that bothered me. So on the inside of the upper rim of one of the sides of the safety glasses, there was like some nomenclature, like serial number or model number, laser engraved in the plastic. Well, it developed a crack. And the crack originated in the letter P in the laser engraving. Evil says, stops waiting for the details on those glasses. Hang in there. So I contact the guys at Philips Safety Products, which is rx-safety.com, I think. And I got on a live chat with their customer support people. And I said, can you give us the, yes, CJ, I'll do that before we sign out, I promise. Can we have your order number? So I give them the order number and they look it up, and you can predict what the first words typed by this this well-meaning operator were. Oh, well, that's over a year old. It's out of warranty. And I said, really? Well, I believe it's a manufacturer's defect because a crack originated from a letter that you laser engraved on the frames. And I have pictures if you would like them. Pregnant pause. Oh, if you have pictures, please send them along. I said, please stand by. And I took the pictures, I can show you the pictures. Let's see. Oh, no, I can't show you the pictures. I didn't queue it up. But I'll show you the pictures. I'll post them. So they come back to me and they said, thank you for the pictures. I'm passing it along to my, the management. And we will get back to you on email. So long story short, they sent me an email. They said, even though it's over a year, we would like to, yeah, there you go. So here's the commercial for these guys. They said, even though it's been over a year, we've looked at your pictures and we would like those back. So here's your RMA number. Please send them back. And I have sent them back. They're taking care of me. Okay. Stay tuned. This story can go either way. So I went back to my last generation of safety glasses, which the prescription difference is very small. But that's the story. On that note, I will say, I will quote CJ Stevens, who says, guys, make sure to hit that like and subscribe before you go. Yes, I would appreciate if you like and subscribe, if you liked it, and if you want to subscribe. If you subscribe, you'll get a notification for the videos, and certainly when the live goes live, and that's an important part of what we do here.
So thanks for being here. This has been PFG Live. You've been awesome. And remember, get flat, stay flat, and we'll see you next week.